Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Ringside Wrap, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. This is where Rich Tate, Les Thatcher, and Mike Sempervivi bring you the latest news and information on pro wrestling and MMA, as well as interviews with legends of yesterday and stars of today. And now, the GWH Radio Network presents Ringside Wrap with your hosts, Rich Tate, Les Thatcher, and Mike Sempervivi.
Good evening, everybody. 2 weeks in a row we've made it. I think that's some kind of recent record. Digging out of the snow a little bit in my neck of the woods, but Mike says he's pretty much avoided it. We wait to get Les on the line. I'm pretty sure Les has seen some snow here in the last few days. We got Jonathan Snowden coming on with us bottom of the hour, 8:30. Probably going to go with him, what do you say, about 45 minutes or so?
I would think so.
All right. Looking forward to some good stuff there. How you doing this week?
Nothing considering we missed the snow. I'm doing fantastic, actually.
Yeah.
Past couple, I mean, you're used to a place that, you know, everything shuts down with 3 inches of snow, let alone, you know, 3 feet of snow, which we've seemed to get the last couple of times out. But, no, thankfully, I can't believe I'm actually saying this, but the snow stayed down south.
You know, a couple of, well, except for, of course, New York and Connecticut. We got a Jersey girl, works with us at our office, and literally we got this conversation today. First day we were able to get into the office this week, and literally, she's sitting there complaining about Atlanta and the way traffic's handled and whatnot. You know, basically I told her, I said, you know, look, you and everybody else that's transplanted from the north down here, tell you what, if you're willing to pay the tax dollars required to get the equipment and the resources to clean up something, you know, once every decade, feel free. But I don't really want my tax dollars going into that. I mean, you know, the normal snow down here is literally maybe 36 hours before you're back out. I mean, you might miss one day of work, if that. And, you know, you're back out on the road, you're good to go. You know, something like this where you're kind of shut in for a few days, not exactly a common occurrence here in the Atlanta area.
No, and you should be used to that. You should be used to that up there, too. I mean, it doesn't work that smoothly up there.
And, of course, as we talk about snow, Les Thatcher joins us. Les, how you doing?
I hate snow. How's that?
Are you under it right now?
Screw snow. I want to cancel my subscription to snow. Thank you very much.
There you go.
We had more snow in December. It was a record snowfall for December for us, and we just had another yesterday. I guess another 5 inches or so, and you guys got. Of course, at least we have something to get it off the streets with.
Right. Yeah. I literally, you know, we were shut in. I mean, it started snowing Sunday night. It had already frozen over Monday morning, obviously. We're stuck in for a couple of days today. I just figured, hey, you know, I got to try to get in and see if we can get something done at the office. And literally what normally takes about, you know, 7-8 minutes took me about a half an hour just to even get outside of my county. What's normally about an hour or 45-50 minute drive without traffic early in the morning. It took me about 2 hours to get there today. It took me about the same getting back home. We didn't have a lot of thawing at all today. And then, of course, I get stuck in the driveway, can't get it in the garage. This will be the first time in about 13 years where I've lived that I've actually had to leave the car out overnight. Going to be hating life in the morning because it's supposed to be 15 degrees, and I'm going to be getting into that car.
Good for you. Welcome to the real world is all I can say.
memories of Ohio. So anyway.
I said to somebody today, they were talking about the snow in Atlanta, and I said, Hartsfield Airport is a madhouse when it's sunshine and it's 75 degrees.
Yeah.
I wouldn't give you a nickel to be in that place in the last 24 hours at all.
So pretty impressive, all three of us back, and two shows in a row that we've been on the air. You know, so far, 2011, shaping up to be a good one.
Are you impressed with that?
I am.
Just the fact we were joking all alive about it, or what?
We were joking about it last week, because you were late coming on, and well, you actually didn't come on, but you know, you were late, and we're sitting here thinking, okay, he'll be here any minute, and I'm talking about, okay, well, you know, October, November was pretty sketchy for us, and it was getting kind of crazy where we didn't even know if we were going to be here. A couple times, actually, Mike just talked to listen to himself talk on the air, and we were just kind of laughing about the fact that the three of us have not actually been on this show, I think, for about 4 months or something like that now.
I think most of us that are married have listened to ourselves talk. I don't think that's a special
feat. I don't know. I think Mike's got that over us.
I wasn't here last week, but then I know you. I got an email saying you'd sent an email, but last Thursday morning I heard my phone beeping. By the way, my cell phone, if anybody's got my cell phone number, if I'm in my house, I ignore that piece of crap. I don't this little tiny things I don't touch. I have an actual a phone in my hand at this moment, which has some heft to it, you know, and I move it more than a quarter of an inch without not hearing anybody. But anyway, I heard my phone beeping last Thursday morning, and I opened it up, and it says, show, ? And I go, what the hell is he talking about? I had no idea. The email you supposedly sent me, I never got. So,
well, you know,
I do answer the telephone, though, when somebody, I don't tweet, I don't text, and I don't live on my computer, but I actually answer my phone if it rings.
And interesting.
Now, is it a rotary phone?
No, it's not. It's cordless.
And no, it's actually one of those two-piece deals where he has to talk into the thing on the box on the wall, and he has to hold the other thing up to his ear.
And it has an off button. Listen as I push it.
Sarah, can you connect me to the show? oh God! But interesting. You mentioned Twitter. Because I want to make sure everybody does know, hey, we're not only just on Facebook now, we are on Twitter, so drop in, check us out. And we also got the chat room going tonight, see some people in there, nobody chatting, that's actually what it's for. Feel free to drop in a question or comment, or get in here and talk to us a little bit, 347-324-5735, be glad to talk to you, got a lot of topics. And of course, Jonathan Snowden coming up here in about, 20, 25 minutes or so. Mike, what's going on right now that you think we need to hit first this week?
Well, one thing I wanted to actually ask Les, I wanted to actually ask him last week, is CM Punk has now taken over Nexus. CM Punk in a position of prominence on Raw, playing the foil to John Cena. I love it in that, I to be honest, I never thought when seeing him in Ring of Honor, I didn't really believe that CM Punk was going to translate well and that WWE was going to use him all that well, and at times they have not. But I always thought he was great because there's a guy who actually claims he's drug-free, and he is drug-free. Doesn't drink, doesn't smoke, doesn't do a whole lot of stupid things outside of the wrestling ring, and I always thought he'd be a great representative if needed, and thought he had a little bit of ability to rap, which to me has taken off. I mean, he's done far better running his mouth in WWE than I ever thought he could. What do you think of him in the position that he's in and kind of taking over the reins of the Nexus?
The Nexus thing, I could care less. I don't care. I mean, I think the whole switch over there, sending Barrett to SmackDown, is that they can sell new T-shirts. Now, see, I'm thinking about it just the way they think about it. I'm not actually thinking about it in wrestling terms. I'm thinking about it in corporate marketing terms.
How can I make a buck off this thing?
You mean these guys really wrestle? What's wrestling? I saw one of the things that said what you had to know how to do if you wanted to be with that company on a website. If you go on there, you know, you can fill out an application to be on Tough Enough. It didn't say anything about knowing how to wrestle. It just, if you have big character and personality and outgoing and I thought, okay, I'm going to sleep and forget about it. No, I think Punk's a good little worker. He's a good talker, and I was impressed with him doing color commentary more than anything else. I like CM. And of the young guys, he's probably really more established in terms of, you know, having a foundation to do something like that. So it's, I don't think it's earth shattering. I'm not, you know, I didn't get jump up and say yay when, you know, when he came out, but I, you know, he's obviously got more experience than the other kids there. And right now that company's got a lot of kids that, probably a year from now, we won't be talking about half of them. You know, they've thrown a lot against the wall, and just a little bit of it's going to stick. But actually, what I was more impressed with the other night was Sheamus and Morrison. And Morrison is the guy. I mean, seriously, right now, as a babyface, I'd clean his act up. What I mean by that, I'd put him in a pair of wrestling trunks and wrestling boots. I know most of the indie kids watch him and think, Jesus, I need a fur coat and sunglasses to be a wrestler. Which is the mindset, don't forget the
slow motion hair flowing with the fan thing.
Oh, right? I gotta have a I can't work for your Fed unless you've got a fan that'll blow my hair. Because I can't work anyway, so I blow my hair a lot. Now, Morris, you know what they all should be watching though, that particular match, which I liked, is the way the little things, the way he sold his arm, the way he kept the arm, you know, to his side and protected it, and his facials and his timing, which is better than most of the kids of, you know, in that age bracket. And when I say that, you know, I'm talking about all the new kids that they've shoved out there. So, I mean, he's a guy I'm really high on. But again, I'm also thinking, you're going to find out, well, no, they'll never find out, but the fact is, I don't care who you are, you dress me up in a Halloween costume, which the business at that level has established now, I'm a character, which doesn't mean I'm a main eventer, just means I'm a character. So that's my point there. He, you know, let him give his fur coat to somebody and dress him like Miz, and you know, and I think he's your guy as far as a babyface is concerned. He and Miz had I heard a hell of an explanation for that. They opened the new year with that Falls Count Anywhere match, and I said, why the hell would you open a show with that? And somebody said, well, you know, they wanted to kick the new year off with a bang, and I said, well, they did, and then they fizzled past that. You know, so if they won any points with somebody that was not a fan with that first match of the new year, they lost them before the hour was up because they put all that nonsense out there, you know. But Morrison's my guy. I like Punk. I really do. But Morrison is the guy I'd be hanging my hat on right now.
Speaking of nonsense, I guess we can get this out of the way, you know. TNA is TNA, but now we have Matt Hardy in TNA, and I'm...
Talk about bad matches. Go ahead.
First thing is, I would say 99% of the time, if you had somebody like Matt Hardy, in most of the time coming from WWE, I would say I would bring him in as a good guy babyface. Because there's a segment that he's got a fan base that seems to love him and travel with him and all of that stuff, and he's an ex-WWE guy. With that said, because of his act on the internet and because of the fact that he has come across, to me at least, and maybe I'm not, you know, the best when it comes to internet and viral video and those sorts of things, he has come across as the biggest, frankly, pardon me, douchebag in the world. I would say book him as such, and it seems like that's what they're going to do, I guess, teaming up with his professional wrestling antichrist brother or however that's working. How would you have brought Matt Hardy in? Because he's so unlikable. Why would you just not go ahead and bring him in as a dirtball?
Well, you know, I think part of the match was they never established what he was. Somebody said to me, how can you have a bad match with RVD? I said, that's pretty easy. If you don't work Rob's style, you're going to have a bad match with him. When I say that, I mean, you know, he's going to get his particular style in, his stuff in. And if you're not into that, then the match is not going to, you know, be tremendous. I mean, it doesn't mean it's going to be horrible, but it's not going to be tremendous. That whole thing is just amazing to me. Talk about Twitter. Rich and him can play. They can get out and twit each other to death, I guess. I don't know.
You calling me a twit?
You twit, don't you? Or is it you tweet? Which is it? Or toot? I don't know what the hell. But somebody said today that he said that all that was just good attention. And, Mike, I think you just said the type of attention it created, unless you're just one of these people that, you know, live and die on every word of the Hardys. I don't think the whole Hardy experiment is getting over that much. First of all, when they put the belt on Jeff, Jeff is not in the forefront. He's always stands behind Bischoff and whoever. That whole thing is just, I don't know. It doesn't do a lot for me. One of the things that caught my eye was a clip of them in Japan. I think the global that first year that they did the global impact thing was one of the damnedest shows they've ever done. I mean, head and shoulders over most anything else they've ever produced. But the thing that drove me crazy is when they were interviewing, or Jeff was cutting a promo or interviewing him, whatever the hell it was, about being in Japan. He's saying, "Well, now that I'm the Antichrist of wrestling." Like I just say, well, good morning, guys, or good evening, guys. How are you? I mean, no emotion. And I'm thinking, okay, if this is really who you're supposed to be, you shouldn't be calling yourself that. First of all, does that make sense to you two of you, what I'm saying? I mean,
oh, yeah!
It's the old thing they say about big names, is you don't give yourself a nickname. And there's the way he's not perceived to be an Antichrist.
And if you're trying to be... If you're trying to be something that I would consider the Antichrist, you're not going to say it like you say, good morning, Mike and Rich. How are you today?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it just, you know, it was just so casual. Like, well, now that I'm the Antichrist of wrestling, you know,
now that I've
blown up the UN
conference for that show, for the Tokyo Dome show.
Yeah.
He was, America's Most Wanted, Bernard. There were guys who did a great job selling, or at least, you know, going out there and attempting to sell their matches to that press. And there's a certain thing that you do when you go to Japan, and, you know, the Road Warrior, you never wore paint. You know, Bruiser Brody would talk normally into the camera. I mean, there's just ways you do things in Japan that he didn't do. Slept walk through completely, had no idea, never brought up the guy he was wrestling, never brought up the fact that the guy he was wrestling went on a learning excursion to America. I mean, this is, you know, things that are actually important to the reason that you're going over there. And then proceeded to go out, blow a leapfrog in the first 20 seconds of the match, and then put on possibly one of the worst matches in Tokyo Dome history. Surely, at least to me, you know, outside of very few matches, the worst title match that ever took place in there, and was horrendous.
Well, that's, you know, I mean, you know, it seems like everything a company gives the big build for always, you know, it's kind of like lighting the firecracker and finding out there's no powder in the tube, right? It just goes, you see the little sparkle, and they go, psst, and it's over, you know. And I'll tell you the best thing I've seen there in a couple weeks is Bobby Roode and Chris Sabin had a wrestling match.
Yeah,
and without Shelley, and I mean, and that's no offense to Shelley, but I mean, when it wasn't a tag match, and you also, I told somebody this a week or so ago after we were talking about this, and I said, it goes to show why the Machine Guns have a better match with Storm and Bobby is because they hold those guys down, they make them work, opposed to let's get our shit in type of thing. And you know, I thought they had a heck of a match. There's a guy, Bobby Roode, who I'd hang as a single worker. I think I would hang a lot of my time on, you know, and push him quite a bit. And Anderson is my champion. No way, just it ain't going to happen. Period. End of story. It's not that he's not charismatic or that, you know, but those promos have gotten to the point where it's all about, I'm going to say something clever, and you better think it's cool. That makes sense. I'm just going to be cool. And it's not cool anymore, or at least not to me.
was only cool in doses, not when you beat people over the head with it. I would guess. This sounds terrible, but what other option do they have? Because when you look at it, it's, who's not damaged goods? If you had to take somebody
I would say
take out Bobby Roode, just because I love that team together for right now. But out of everyone there right now, who would you put there?
Gosh, I don't know, because that's the way that company's been handled. AJ has been a clown and a heel and a baby face and the carry of the company and the butt of everybody's joke. It's run full circle how many times?
If you ask TNA, he's still the next big young star, even though he's been doing this for how long now?
He's not a young star. That's one of the jokes we used to have years ago. You know, somebody to be announced as an up-and-coming star has been in the business 15 years. it's a way of saying something, but it don't mean much. I think they change their mind every 15 minutes, or so it seems, with everybody. And I can't emphasize enough, every time you switch from babyface to heel or goofball to serious and back again, that person, I don't give a damn how good their in-ring product is, how good their in-ring work is, they lose something. They lose their effectiveness to draw you people, because then it becomes a show. I mean, just a complete, and it's, you know, it, you don't hang a sign out and say this is all a work and it's a show, but that's, you know, nobody starts taking it seriously, because how long, you know, now they said that, Saban and Shelley, they lost because Shelley nailed Saban instead. So I said, oh, my God, they're going to break him up. I said, well, of course they are. That's what tag teams do in TNA. They break up. There's really nobody, Mike, that I would say. I think the whole MMA thing with Jeff Jarrett is just a mockery, and it's stupid. I don't know. I think that company is right exactly, no matter what they do at this point, I think they are where they're at. I don't think that there is any way to elevate that entire process to where you're going to see them pick up a huge number on ratings on their TV show, or where somebody's going to say, my God, they've doubled their pay-per-view buys. I just don't think it's going to happen.
If I'm at Spike, you know what I'm doing right now? To hell with TNA, Ring of Honor, come on over here.
Boy, you know, for me, that would be nice.
Yeah, that's more of a selfish move, obviously. But, you know, let's face it, the best wrestling promotion going loses its TV deal, and the crappiest one of the majors going just continues to, I don't know.
Did they lose the TV deal, or did they just not renew it?
It wasn't renewed by HDNet.
Okay.
So they haven't, you know, through April, and it's not like they're closing the door, apparently. They are going to do, you know, the possibility of specials and things like that. And it's just, to me, it's one of those things that's, it's kind of weird because, okay, yeah, it could be, you know, obviously it's bad because there's no TV, and it was very slick, and much like WEC, you know, there's going to be a show going away where every time you watched it, you were watching a show for free that was really, really good TV. Almost every time out, good to great shows, for, you know, when people had the chance to see them. But there's the thing. Most people didn't have a chance to see them because they were on HDNet, and most people didn't get it. So,
yeah. I think that's the deal, Mike, because, you know, here, you know, in a capsule, when you look at those three companies, is Raw the greatest show in the history of wrestling? Absolutely not. Not currently, anyway. But look, it's more importantly, they're going to get exposed because the great shows that surround them on USA, White Collar, Burn Notice, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? So they're on a network that's hot. So they get, I mean, and not that they don't contribute to it, I don't mean that, but it's all the sum of all the parts that makes that network important. How much do you watch Spike other than because you're a wrestling fan, or because you work on wrestling talk shows, you watch Spike? Do you watch A Thousand Ways to Kill Your Wife or some of that silliness? I might see it if I'm channel surfing for a minute and then move on, but there's not really that much on Spike other than, you know, and of course then you get right, you know, you go to the third thing we're just talking about, Ring of Honor on HDNet. I don't even know what the hell is on HDNet. First of all, I don't get it here. On my, I have DirecTV and I don't get it on my my deal. And if I did, I'm not sure there's anything on there I'd watch. So it's kind of a familiarity thing, you know. I mean, it's like if they were on NBC or CBS or ABC, you're obviously going to catch them by accident. If no, you know, even if you don't want to, sometimes, and you're going to see the plugs for them because you're watching a lot of shows on that channel. And I think that's. That's one of the reasons right now that that WWE is, you know, holding their own. I don't think it's because of Santino and the other idiot who can't get over the top rope being the tag team champions. That's for damn sure. Am I starting off the new year with a negative attitude? I hope.
Oh, no.
You know, you want to know the truth. I honestly love kibitzing with you guys, but I think, I get tired of hearing me be negative for 2 hours. I mean, I really do, and there's not a lot to be positive about.
Well, and we, you know, we kind of talked about it last week, and actually I was supposed to call you this week, but hell, snow got in the way.
It blocked your phone?
Yeah. I had to dig it out. You know, more or less, I mean, you know, we've kind of really decided to kind of change the direction of the program just to get to where we actually aren't sitting here dissecting Raw every week and TNA every week and more or less just hit the topics and run with it and throw anything else in and hopefully that gets us away because bottom line is when you're sitting there watching Raw or you're watching Impact, you're sitting there thinking of all the things that you absolutely hate about doing it and instead of just looking for the positive and hanging on the positive.
So you can't stop stupid. You can't argue with stupid. So you know, exactly. Much like TNA, there's only so much you can talk about with them anyway. It's like, and there is some good things. I guess there's always good things until, you know, they end up getting ruined. But one good thing as of now, Morrison did come from this, but Tough Enough returning. As a concept for Tough Enough, I guess they're taking it back to when it was on MTV the first time around. Yeah, obviously they're not using tracks. I guess they're going to be in Los Angeles, and they have a facility there. Less as it stands now, I guess they had. I thought I heard Dave Meltzer say that they were looking for guys with some experience. Although, like you noted, with that open casting call, it was all about, you know, the very typical, you know, MTV style of mentality of, you know, or WWE style of mentality of looking for the entertainment first, but. What did you? I say I know you liked. I believe you liked the first show with Al and everything. What would you do for this one? And who would you have there as, you know, you're in the Al Snow position, or the Hugh Morrison
position? I would bring somebody that didn't work for the company, that didn't give a damn what the company thought. That's when I say that. I mean they need to cut somebody loose because if the new Tough Enough is anything like the NXT, then I won't be watching it either because I'm really not concerned that Daniel Bryan has a double date with the Bellas on neck. I mean, it's just, you know, I've discussed this with several people, and they say, well, you know, they don't want to give away the business has been given away, for Christ's sake, by having mediocre workers in the damn ring. You give the business away. I don't give a damn if you're trying to or not. I honestly believe that to show people how extremely hard it is to become a legitimate professional wrestler, not sports entertainer, professional wrestler, would be interesting, entertaining, informative, and it's just I don't know who I'd put in that position, but it would be somebody You know what? I wouldn't have a problem putting Tommy Pritchard in there if he didn't have to get a check that was signed from Stanford. I wouldn't have a problem putting Ricky in there, Steamer in there, if he didn't have to get a check that was signed from Stanford. Because then you are limited. You have to stay within their boundaries. And I've seen both those guys operate outside of those boundaries, or Harley, or hell, you know, I'm hardly a company man, but I mean, to me, a little more of the Bob Holly character and a little less of the other stuff. You know, everybody seems to be down on Bob with that whole thing with him and Matt. You know, that happened there, but I'm not interested in him than somebody of that nature going in and beating the hell out of a bunch of kids either. But there's nothing. You know what? The truth is far more entertaining and a lot, you know, than fiction a lot of times. And if they're going to contrive something like they contrived on NXT, I'm not buying in. I don't want to see it. And all you're doing then is creating the ripple effect. We have enough warm bodies in this industry below that level that think all you need is a funny face, music, hand signals, and a stupid costume to be a wrestler, and they have no friggin' in-ring talent. And I think it's, you know, there's nothing wrong with telling people what actually, you know, and I don't want to say you don't have to tell, well, here's what a finish is, and let me explain to you about a finish, this and that, but the, you know, what it takes physically and mentally to be a Ricky Steamboat, you know, or a Daniel Bryan for that matter, I think is what it needs to be. And I don't know. I'm leery, guys. I really am. You know, Nexus was the next, or NXT was the innovative, groundbreaking show, which turned into the dating game, or, you know.
Hey Les, I hate to cut that off, because but I'm sorry, that was beautiful, the dating game. Maybe we could pick up there in a little bit. We're going to take a 60 second break, and we'll be back with our guest Jonathan Snowden.
Hello and welcome to today's lottery drawing. Good luck. And here's today's winning numbers. First one up, it's not yours. Second one, not yours. And another number that's not yours. Okay, this is one number that's yours. It's a 5, but you don't get any money for that. And the final number is not yours.
Yep, so chances are you're not going to hit the lottery anytime soon. Don't get us wrong. The lottery can be fun every now and then. Just please don't rely on it for your future savings. How about this? Brew your own coffee at home instead of buying that latte every day. Brown bag it to work instead of ordering in. Ride your bike instead of buying all that gas. These changes alone can save you thousands a year. Thousands. Small changes today, big bucks tomorrow. Feed that piggy bank. Go to feedthepig.org for more free ideas on how to save.
Feedthepig.org.
This message brought to you by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants and the Ad Council.
Tell you what, I did not like that commercial at all. I don't like anyone telling me how many lattes I should and shouldn't be buying, but enough about that. What everyone should be buying are 2 books. The first one called Total MMA, and the second one called The MMA Encyclopedia, both from ECW Press and both from the author who joins us right now, Mr. Jonathan Snowden. Jonathan, thank you very much for coming on with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. I hate that I interrupted that rant earlier. That was going pretty well. I hate to put a stop to it.
It's been said that Les Thatcher gets a little angry every once in a while when discussing current professional wrestling. So,
I
take that back. What has turned into sports entertainment?
But I'll take a sedative, Jonathan, and you take the wheel and drive for a while, okay?
No problem.
Well, Jonathan, I mean, it's your newest book, The MMA Encyclopedia, has just come out. Your first one, Total MMA, Inside Ultimate Fighting, was a pretty big success as far as a very big critical success, and everyone that's read it has been quite the fan of it, because I didn't get it initially when it had come out, but I looked at some reviews and I talked to some people about it, and everyone absolutely raved about the book. And it was so successful, you came out with the encyclopedia. What got you into wanting to write books about MMA anyway, for those people out there who are unfamiliar with your work?
Well, I mean, the simple answer is that I wanted to write a book about MMA because I wanted to read a book about MMA. There were none out there. There was one book that was pretty good. It was called No Holds Barred by Clyde Gentry, But you know, that was really the only thing on the marketplace, and it ended in 1997. You know, that was kind of the end of the story as far as Clyde's book is concerned. It didn't really address MMA in Japan in a way that made sense to me. And you know, there were a lot of questions I had. I joined the Army in 2001 and missed a little bit of what was going on with MMA. And when I came back in 2005, it was like a totally different landscape. You know, it went from being this thing where I would get bootleg VHS tapes from somebody that happened to have satellite because you couldn't get the pay-per-view on cable, to a thing where it was on national television, you know, and I was curious about exactly how that happened, and there was no good answer. And so, it kind of the spur of the moment, I wrote an email to Michael Holmes at ECW Press, and I said, look, you guys should really have a book about the history of MMA, and why don't you? And I proposed that I could do it. I don't know why I thought I could do it, but I sent that email, and he wrote back and said that, you know what, you're right. Somebody should do it, and why don't you try writing a sample chapter, and we'll see what we can do from there. And that was kind of how I got started writing about MMA. So it was just kind of a spur of the moment idea on my part that really has stolen all of my free time for like 5 years now.
Now, I know in the book, obviously you talk to Frank Shamrock, and there are, you know, plenty of people who were, you know, quite open to talking to you. Did you meet any resistance off anyone? Because I hosted a talk show, co-hosted a talk show in 2003, I believe we began, and it was very easy to get anyone on to talk, anyone from the UFC on to talk. Dana White was actually on the show. Everything was hunky-dory and great. And as UFC grew, it became a little more difficult and much more painful to try to deal with talking to people. And as far as their openness goes, a lot of people talk off the record, but they had to change their ways on the record. Did you meet any resistance from anyone or from any certain circles as far as wanting to talk to you?
Oh, in the beginning, it was nothing but resistance. I mean, you're right. Just the fact that I could find a number and call somebody like Frank Shamrock makes MMA different than any other major sport. Like, if I decided all of a sudden I wanted to write a book about professional football, I couldn't call up and talk to Joe Montana without, you know, I probably could do that right now. So, I mean, it was possible that I could get on the phone with some people from MMA, but certainly there was resistance. But it was just kind of like this thing where, you know, it's like life. It's like about networking. So I would, my initial interviews were with someone like Vernon White and Jason DeLucia from the Lion's Den. And then from there, you know, I got the connection to Guy Metzger. And from there, I talked to Frank and eventually to Ken Shamrock. I mean, so it was just kind of this thing where over the course of a year and a half while I was writing this book, I was able to utilize the people I had met in the industry and kind of take some pretty amazing leaps. Because you're right, I mean, there's no reason for these people to talk to me, especially at the time. You know, I wasn't somebody from like a website with a lot of readers or anything. I was literally a guy off the street. So, you know, I was real fortunate. I think it was harder when I wrote it than it would have been a couple of years before that. And I think right now to do what I did, which was come off the street and write a book about MMA and be able to talk to all these people, would be pretty impossible unless you're with a major publisher. So I kind of got in at exactly the right time to do what I did.
What was the biggest head-turning surprise for you in the process of writing the first book? The second book, as people will find out later, I think the biggest head-turning thing would be getting threats. But when it came to the first book, what's the biggest thing where you just, maybe even now, just kind of shake your head out like, wow, you know, I didn't see that going that way or something like that?
Well, you know, the thing that amazed me, and you guys probably know this as wrestling fans, you know, I knew a little bit about how connected the sport of MMA was to professional wrestling, especially in Japan. But I didn't really realize until I started researching the book and talking to people, like how intimately connected MMA is to professional wrestling, even in the Americas. You know, a lot of people even today think like, oh yeah, MMA in Japan, that sprang from pro wrestling, but not here in the United States. But you know, of course, that's not true at all. And so much of it goes back. All the way back to catch wrestlers and you know, the original athletic shows and the carnival workers and the shooters and, you know, the kind of intermingling with judo. That's the basis of everything that made MMA successful in the beginning in the UFC. So, I mean, that was really the most interesting part to me because that was stuff that I didn't know. So it's always cool when you start a project and you have an idea and you think you know what it is you're talking about, and then you realize about halfway through that you've got a lot to learn. So it was fun to teach myself things, you know, that I didn't know. And I think that's what kind of helped make the book successful, even with fans, you know, because a lot of MMA fans are really hardcore fans, and they've been around for a long time before there was any media coverage and stuff like that. But there's a lot of experts in the community. But, you know, I think even for the most part, even people who have been following the sport for more than a decade all found things that they didn't know in Total MMA. And that was because, you know, I was able to find things I hadn't known before. So I think that was interesting. You know, the pro wrestling connection, I think, was my favorite part. Makes MMA fans furious, but it was my favorite part.
That's right. It seems to me MMA fans, anytime any reference to boxing or professional wrestling ever comes up, it dares even come close to touching their sport, they always, you know, throw fits and get upset and, you know, always have complaints about people like Brock Lesnar and the like, when it just, you know, these canvas-matted sports are all related in their, you know, obviously they're, you know, very unique, but at the same time, they're very also, you know, interlaced and tied together. How big of a professional wrestling fan and a boxing fan were you, you know, if at all, while you were growing up?
Huge professional wrestling fan, pretty casual boxing fan. I like boxing, and I was one of those people that would always watch the big fights on HBO and stuff like that. And of course, my friends would get together and we'd watch Tyson fights and stuff like that. But you know, I wasn't like a hardcore boxing fan the way I was professional wrestling. I grew up all over the place, but we kind of settled down in Columbia, South Carolina. So I was a fan of what I call like the real professional wrestling, the National Wrestling Alliance, not the stuff from up in New York. So that was kind of what I grew up loving. And then I was lucky enough to also, you know, have relatives all over the country. So you know, I had family in Oklahoma and Texas, so when I would go and visit, we'd go and watch the Von Erichs and stuff like that. So, I mean, wrestling was a huge part of my life as I was growing up. Just a huge fan.
Now, what did you ever think about Les Thatcher?
No.
I don't know if
who's he?
I thought Les Thatcher was tremendous, a great talent. One of the best that I recall.
I owe him a check. This check's in the mail, John. Are you from Columbia? They used to go to the old Township Auditorium?
Absolutely, Township Auditorium. And, you know, I even went back not that long. I mean, it's probably been a while ago now, 10 years or so, and we saw an ECW show. And it just reminded me, it's like, what a great building the Township is to watch wrestling in. I don't know what it was like to be a performer there, but to watch it, it was tremendous because every seat was like, you know, you might as well have been ringside with every seat. Even when you're up in the balcony, you could just, it felt like you were almost like right inside the ring. And, you know, I've never watched wrestling anyplace else that had those kind of sight lines and was just a tremendous place. And, you know, it was so much fun because when I was a kid, it was really at the height of what was going on with Dusty Rhodes as the Booker and the Rock and Roll Express and the Russians and then the Four Horsemen. And, you know, it was a real exciting time to be a kid and be a wrestling fan. And I was one of those strange fans that was kind of I liked the heels, you know, even as a child. So, I mean, it was fun to get in arguments with people and stuff like that. In the South, I mean, there's college football and there's wrestling. At least that's what there was when I was growing up. So, you know, it brings back memories just to even think about this stuff.
It was a great building to work in, honestly. I loved it there. And the audience, and you know, each town has its own feel. And Columbia was always easy to get, you know, to get a pop from the people. I mean, to get them up. I'll never forget one night Nelson Raw and I worked with at Freddie Sweet Tan and I forget who his partner was now, but anyway, they attacked us as we came to the ring and really started building our heat before we ever got our jackets off. And then when they finally brought us into and we finally hit the comeback, that place was so loud. And Nelson was yelling high spots to me that out loud, and nobody could have heard us in the front row. I mean, we could have talked about the whole match. The audience sound level was that high, and talk about an adrenaline rush. You know, when you realize you've got those people just at that fever pitch. I mean, that's why all of us keep coming back for more. But yeah, it was a great building, a hell of a good town to work in. I loved it.
Yeah, and the thing about go ahead.
Oh no, please.
Well, I was just gonna say the thing about Columbia. You're talking about the fans would be quick with a pop. You know, I think that's a product of the fact that we were all Carolina Gamecock football fans, and there was never very much to cheer about. So when wrestling came into town, you know, anything would seem exciting to us after watching some of the college football. So we were always glad to get some excitement into town.
Yeah, I remember Mulligan. I think it was a new Cadillac or something. He hadn't had the car a week or so and got his tires slashed. He came out of the building and had to buy new tires. They cut the damn tires on his new car. So they were feverish about their wrestling, that's for sure.
John, that was no one in your family, was it?
No.
No, I don't think so. I think we were not guilty, although I did have a friend, Justin. We went out to the wrestling matches once, and we saw Lex Luger in the parking lot, and I hate to say it, but he'd spit at Lex Luger, and then Lex chased him around a little bit, and that was like the exciting moment from our time to the wrestling match.
In the last week, there have been announcements made, big announcements from both the UFC and Strikeforce. Strikeforce has announced that they've got the heavyweight title tournament upcoming, or at least the beginning is of such, and the UFC has announced that Brock Lesnar and Junior Dos Santos will be the coaches on the upcoming Ultimate Fighter show. I guess take the UFC first, since most of the people listening to this show are, you know, far more familiar with the UFC than they are with Strikeforce, and they're far more familiar with the name Brock Lesnar, that even despite his title loss to Cain Velasquez, I don't really think hurt his cachet amongst too many people as far as wanting to see eyes, you know, putting eyes on him. What is your opinion of Lesnar, who obviously has changed his ways in the fact that after he got sick, he seems to be genuinely a happier person, and with his kids seems to be just a genuinely happier guy than he was before. With that said, he still doesn't like a whole lot of cameras around him at all times. What's your opinion on this show upcoming? Because Dos Santos, a lot of people don't know his English isn't that good, but he's a very personable and likable guy, and I think that'll come through. But with that said, what do you think is going to come from this? Because do you think the UFC is hoping a little bit for a huge Brock meltdown, or are they just satisfied with having him on there week after week?
I think they're expecting a big Brock meltdown, or at least, you know, understanding that Brock knows that something exciting needs to happen on television. And that's the thing about Brock Lesnar. You know, anytime we kind of say, oh, he's this kind of guy or he's that kind of guy, you always have to remember where he comes from. And, you know, he's a guy that understands how to manipulate an audience. So, you know, who knows what the real Brock Lesnar is like, but certainly I think that he knows that he can't be boring on this TV show. But I think it's really cool. I'm glad they were able to make this happen. You know, I wrote on my website, bloodyelbow.com, just earlier in the week, I speculated that Dana White must have a big announcement, and that was the only reason he wasn't making any statements about the Strikeforce tournament, because normally he'd be downplaying Strikeforce and saying lots of bad things about it. I figured because he was being quiet, he had a big announcement, and he does. Of course, this is huge to get Brock Lesnar on The Ultimate Fighter. Brock is the biggest star. I think at this point you have to say he's the biggest star in UFC history, at least certainly as far as pay-per-view goes. So, I mean, to have him on for 12 weeks of television, it's just amazing for them. So, you know, and I think it's a great thing for the promotion. And as a fan, I'm really excited about it just to see what he's going to do, because that, you know, that'll be why we tune in. It'll be one of the Ultimate Fighters, kind of like the third one where you had Tito Ortiz and Ken Shamrock, and the one with Rampage and Rashad Evans, where you're kind of just watching the coaches more than you are any of the fighters on the show. And I think that'll be what this is about. It'll be all about Brock Lesnar. And every week we'll be wondering, all right, what's Brock going to do? When's he finally going to snap? What's he going to say? How many doors is he going to knock down? It's going to be pretty riveting as far as reality television goes.
Now, a lot of people's first reaction when they heard about it were, Brock Lesnar's going to coach somebody. Tell people, or how does it work exactly as far as who is actually doing most of the coaching when it comes to these shows? Obviously, these guys aren't doing – it's not like they're sitting up in the studio somewhere and then only coming down for TV time. They are working, but how much is really done by the team that they bring with them?
Yeah, honestly, I've read a lot of articles, and that's kind of like the latest internet talking point. It's like, oh, the coaching is all done by the guys they bring along with them. And they do definitely bring technical experts along with them when they coach the Ultimate Fighter. But how much the fighter is involved in the training, it really depends a lot. Because, for these books, I've talked to a lot of the guys that were on the Ultimate Fighter. And, you know, some of the coaches hardly show up at all. That's absolutely true. But then sometimes you get guys like a Matt Hughes who trains a lot with the guys. You know, he's down there rolling around with them and stuff. So, it really depends. So, you know, the guys can get pretty good training from Lesnar's team, even if Lesnar himself isn't training with them. And I want to say that this is a show of welterweights, guys at 170 pounds. So there's only so much that Brock Lesnar is going to be able to demonstrate on a guy that he could probably pick up with one arm, you know. So that's probably not that huge a deal.
Now, over on the Strikeforce side, as a fan of professional wrestling, is, you know, growing up in the same area you did, Jonathan, the UWF title tournament, the TV Mid-South TV title tournament, the Crockett Cup coming to ball. I love tournaments. I love K-1 having tournaments. Well, I used to, at least. One of the reasons I started hating them was because of substitutions, was because of I love tournaments when it comes to playoffs and team sports, but when it comes to individual sports, the Super Six has shown this. Because of all the, it's just, to me, in fighting, you shouldn't have tournaments. Strikeforce has got a tournament going on. What is your opinion as it stands as far as just tournaments in general in mixed martial arts? Are they I know it's something that separates Strikeforce. I know it's something they let fans vote on saying they like it. But what is your opinion on any sort of tournament format in boxing or MMA?
Well, I mean, I should say first that, you know, I understand where you're coming from for sure. I mean, it's risky. Running a tournament is risky for the reasons you said, which is, you know, that the guys could get injured along the way, and all of a sudden you have, you know, two guys you've never heard of fighting in the finals, you know. That said, the MMA has kind of been built on the tournament format, so I'm kind of partial to it. I mean, your first 10 or 11 UFC shows were all tournament shows. And some of the great shows in Japan for Pride were all tournaments. And like you mentioned, K-1 has a history of great kickboxing tournaments. So, you know, if you've been an MMA fan for a long time, you've probably seen some pretty great tournaments. And that's kind of, I think, why they're doing this, Strikeforce. You know, they're looking for their angle. I mean, the UFC has most of the most famous and most marketable fighters. So, you know, this is kind of like a wrestling promotion that needs a lot of gimmicks, right? This is their version of the cage match. You know, this is their gimmick show. And that's what the tournament is for them. It brings back fond memories for a lot of fans, and that's kind of what they're hoping for.
If either Fedor or Alistair Overeem don't advance for one reason or another, because I would assume, you know, because I would say a couple years ago, I would definitely have said, Barnett Fedor would be a big match in America because I really like Barnett's mouth and ability, and I just think he sells himself great and could do it in a great fashion. Obviously, because of a lot of circumstances, that his cachet has dropped a lot and Overeem's has increased from over the years. If they don't get that matchup, is it a disappointment? And did you think there would be any sense in having that fight so you know it's guaranteed and you know you're at least going to have that one big fight right off the bat that you can hang your hat on? Or what's your opinion on the way they're going through it now with currently Fedor facing Antonio Silva?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, if you look at the brackets of the tournament, it's a little bit unusual because, you know, the guys you consider the top four seeds are all on one side of the tournament, and the guys that need a little bit a little bit more cachet and maybe need to be built up a little bit are all on the other side. So, you know, from a pro wrestling type perspective, that works perfectly because you get to build the one guy on the right-hand side of the bracket, build him up so that by the time he meets the bigger stars from the left-hand side of the bracket, he's ready. You know, I think it makes sense to do the matchup you want the most as soon as you can, which I think is why Fedor and Overeem are on the same side of the bracket. I mean, we've seen this with the UFC, and the example that I use is Ken Shamrock and Tank Abbott, which was a match that the UFC badly wanted for a long time. They finally got these guys in the same tournament, and before they could meet, Ken Shamrock broke his hand in a previous fight, and they never got the match. It was never made, and you know, it was one of the great missed opportunities. So I think, you know, Strikeforce, probably, you know, the guys there know stuff like that, and they want to try to get to Fedor and Overeem as quickly as possible because I think that's the big match that people want to see. And, you know, as far as the other matches with the other guys, I think all that's going to depend on how well the tournament goes. And if it builds nicely and they have some great matches in the beginning of the tournament, then I think it'll take care of itself. And it'll be interesting inherently by the time it gets to the end, no matter who's in it, as long as the finishes are good and the fights are good and, you know, they tell the story the right way in the broadcast. I think that's going to be the most important thing.
Now, there's a lot of people out there listening who, you know, they were, you know, a little bit older, and they've been longtime wrestling fans, and they haven't necessarily been MMA fans, and I've kind of told them, you know, hey, in a lot of ways, MMA out pro wrestling is pro wrestling when it comes to how it's presented, and obviously through the Ultimate Fighter show, how they've been able to build personalities and make riveting TV with just very simple things that basically professional wrestling shows used to do. So we always try to tell them, you know, the names and things like that. And when it comes to looking up names, you got the MMA encyclopedia that you just wrote, which was this the same sort of thought when it came to the total MMA book, when it was just, you know, you wanted a book to be able to read about MMA, with the exception of, like, Sherdog, which is great for, you know, instant statistics, there was never a book put out with, I don't know if people know who any of these guys from the past ever were, and you've given people the ability to now have a little capsule bio and actually know who everyone is, or at least almost everyone. What were your thoughts leading into doing the MMA Encyclopedia book? Because, you know, reference books can be kind of hard for a lot of people to sell to people and to even compile, because you don't want to leave too much out, but you got to have the right amount in. I mean, what was the thought process like in going into this book?
Yeah, you know, it was hard because, you know, really what happened, the genesis of the second book was there was so much stuff I had to cut out of Total MMA just to make it readable and to create a narrative, you know, the storytelling. You couldn't interrupt your storytelling and the story of MMA with a thousand little asides, like it was like, you know, a giant version of the Wrestling Observer newsletter, you know, where all of a sudden there's like a bunch of paragraphs about, you know, some little thing in there, you know, and that was stuff that's great, and I love that about the newsletter, but as far as like a book goes, that wasn't the way to do it, to tell a cohesive story. So that's why, you know, I thought the encyclopedia would be different, because you could take each of these individual little subjects and then, you know, and expound on them to at much greater length than I was able to in the first book. So, I mean, what I think it was cool that you kind of picked up on right away is that it's a little bit different than what you see in SureDog or on Wikipedia or something, where you can see some statistics and you can see that, you know, that Mark Coleman's record is 16-12 or whatever it is. Those are facts. What we were trying to do in our little capsule bios was put those facts into a context. So, you know, what did we think about Mark Coleman? What does that record mean? What was the perception of him like in the year 2000? You know, those kind of things. Like, you know, that with other sports that, you know, it kind of comes naturally to people because sports have that built-in history. But you're right that MMA doesn't. And you know, the UFC doesn't encourage that either. So there's so much of the story that's been untold for most of the fans that have been around for only like 3 or 4 years. You're right, they don't know any of these guys. So I thought it was important to get that stuff out there and tell these guys' stories, because they are the ones that built the industry. And, you know, I wanted to make sure that, that we did them justice.
Have you ever had any problem with, well, basically like the untold truth when it comes to Nobuhiko Takada, you know, throwing a suplex on Mark Coleman, a vertical suplex, you know, his position was done for a reason, and if it wasn't for him and it wasn't for Antonio Inoki's fight, that obviously we probably wouldn't be where we are right now when it comes to MMA. With that said, when it comes time to telling the story of like a Mark Coleman and guys like that, as a fan of MMA, is there any concern in the long run when you look back and people maybe discounting what the pro wrestling aspect, you know, when it comes to like a, you know, a little aside about, you know, bringing up something about a Coleman or a UWFI fight or a early Pride fight or even early UFC fights, you always hear stories, you can only confirm some of them, and others you just have to go where they works or where they not. And do you have any problem with trying to, when you write the history, but you're not, much like pro wrestling, you're not real sure if what you're hearing is the God's honest truth, because you can't, you can only go off the rumors.
Right. And it's an awful way to type.
That may have been the worst question I have ever phrased in my entire life, but if you get the point to that.
I think, you know, I do understand what you're saying, though, because, you know, when especially when there's controversy involved, and in MMA, there's nothing more controversial than working fights, you know, especially now. At the time, maybe it wasn't such a big deal, but now if you think about it with the athletic commissions and all the money behind it and network television, it'd be fairly embarrassing, I think, for someone that's recently been on UFC TV like Mark Coleman. If a lot of people knew that he had thrown fights before or done works, you know, that might be, you know, it might be kind of a big deal. So there is some, you know, you do have that hesitation as a writer and just as a human being, like, you know, do I want to put this guy in a situation where I get him in a lot of trouble? But you have to balance that in. And then you're wondering, like you said, like, you know, what is the truth? You hear different versions of the truth. That's one where I think it's pretty clear that the Takada-Mark Coleman fight was pretty clearly a work. You know, Dave Meltzer has told me that they actually consulted with him on what the finish should be. And, you know, so that's pretty transparent. And, you know, and Coleman's training partner, Mark Kerr, it's pretty clear that it's a work. And Coleman says things like, when I interviewed him, he says things like, well, I had to feed my family. You know, he didn't actually confirm that he had done anything wrong. But, you know, just kind of that was what he said about it. So, you know, that's one of the ones I don't feel that bad about. You know, it's pretty clear what happened there. But, you know, there's lots of fights. And, you know, once you bring in Japanese MMA and so many wrestling guys, you know, everything is thrown into question. And it is hard to try to figure out what was real and what wasn't. And that's what makes it interesting.
Well, I'm sure you saw the 2004 Pride Grand Prix tournament, Hidehiko Yoshida and Kiyoshi Tomura. Tomura was so great at shoot style professional wrestling that even though he completely decimated you, the inside of Yoshida's leg, there were still people to this day, and you know what, for all I know they could be right, that still scream that fight was a work, because that's how good Tomura is. When you go back and watch those fights, do you look for anything, or has it ever stuck out to you about anything, you know, before you got into really reading, that what you were seeing, you know, wasn't the case? I mean, obviously, you know, when they were very obvious, they were very obvious, but were there any fights where you went back and looked because you heard something about them and went, well, I'll be damned, you know, that there was something that gave something away?
Yeah, I mean, so many of them are hard to tell, and most of them, like you say, you know, if you've watched professional wrestling a lot, if you've watched shoot style wrestling especially, like the old UWF stuff and UWFI and rings, you know, you can kind of pick up on it, that as the fluid movements on the ground, the way guys just kind of give up positions and things like that, the punches that are landing a lot on the shoulders and not to the head, like, you know, a lot of stuff is real obvious. Like when you watch Coleman and Takada, and Takada and Kyle Sturgeon and stuff like that. But then you get into some that are like, you know, you hear that they were works. One that stands out is Gary Goodridge and Noya Agawa. You know, people say that was a work fight. You watch that fight and these guys are wailing on each other with hard punches, and you ask yourself, like, wow, okay, I've heard that this is a work fight, but if it was, man, they weren't very careful about it. You know what I mean? Like they're potatoing the hell out of each other, like they were Stan Hansen. So I mean, you know, it's questionable. You know, you have to take a lot of it with a grain of salt. Like, do we assume that was a work fight just because the pro wrestler won in the end? So that's interesting.
Now, everyone seems to be pretty happy when it comes to the MMA encyclopedia. Right, almost everyone seems to be happy when it comes to the book. Obviously, in anything, there's going to be a couple people that were left out. I mean, there's just, you know, that's why there are second, third, and fourth editions of things, for God's sake. You know, heaven forbid that you maybe forget about someone in the when it comes to listing them, because there's been so many fighters from over the years. Was there anyone in particular that was upset with you for leaving you out?
I do hear occasionally, like I do a lot of interviews for the website, and you know, I'll talk to guys, and you know, occasionally someone will kind of say like, oh, you know, maybe next time I'll win, and maybe next time I'll be in the encyclopedia, because you know, there a lot of the guys are not in it, especially the modern guys, you know, because it is historical, and you know, you're looking backwards and not forwards. So a guy who has a lot of his career in front of him and maybe hasn't been a championship-level fighter yet isn't in it. The most important person that almost wasn't in it, which, you know, I've told the story before, but when we turned in the final draft of the book, my co-author and I, Kendall Shields, and we're looking through it, and we realized when we're in the L section that there's no entry for Brock Lesnar. This is on the day that the book was due. That was a problem.
That's so, you know, are there any saints we're forgetting? Anybody named Saint something?
Exactly. There's one thing, you know, there was one guy that was, I never heard from him. I heard from people associated with him. He's a guy named Benji Raddick, and he's a tough fighter, was in the IFL, and, you know, he's a pretty good fighter. Didn't make the book, and some of his people were furious, and you know, if they saw me, they're going to kick the crap out of me, and you know, and all these things. So that was the worst. That's the worst reaction I've got from a fighter or their camp, which is pretty bad. I guess it doesn't get much worse than we're going to beat you up if we see you. So if there's a second version, he's going to be in it no matter what.
Now, what was your response to that outside of, like, I mean, was it just like, hey, calm down, you know, it was an oversight, sorry? Or, like, how was that, what was your reaction, like, opening, you know, or hearing that message and, like, you know, how did you respond to it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to lie. I mean, it wasn't an oversight, and I didn't tell him that. I mean, it's a conscious choice. We made a list of who we wanted in the book, and the guy wasn't one of them. You know, I mean, they were complaining about other people that were in, like Gina Carano, who's not a real fighter because she's a woman, and Kimbo Slice, they didn't think was a real fighter because, you know, he was a backyard brawler. But, I mean, you're talking about two of the most famous fighters in modern history there, you know, Kimbo Slice drawing the huge television rating unparalleled in MMA history, and Gina being the first female fighter to headline a nationally televised card. Like, you know, if these are the people that this guy thinks he should be in the book ahead of, you know, that's like, you know, well, I don't want to disparage anyone, but it would be like if, like, you know, Randy Mulkey was like, well, why is Ric Flair in this book and I'm not? Well, yeah, there's a reason that, you know, he's in the book and you're not. You know, you're a great guy, but, you know, Ric Flair was more important to wrestling history, and the same with Kimbo Slice compared to Benji Raddick.
Now, you could even say that, even living through them getting the first big wins and then having Mulkey Mania run wild?
I know. I feel horrible that I said that. But, you know,
you guys just mentioned something. Let me ask a question. What's ever happened to Kimbo Slice?
Well, you know, they're supposedly training him up for boxing. His promo, he's associated with Gary Shaw and his son Jared Shaw, who were running Elite XC, the MMA promotion. They're both they're old time boxing promoters, and they're kind of bringing Kimbo into that sport. So we've been hearing for the last year. I actually play fantasy football with Jared Shaw, and you know, he's been talking about the big splash that Kimbo's going to make in boxing in 2011, so that's probably where you'll see him pop up somewhere doing a boxing match, probably a work boxing match.
That's, Oh God! I get just now. I guess he's got some brutage too. Is Emmanuel Burton, I believe he's related to down the line. There was a great little, I mean, great club fighter. In fact, his fight with Mickey Ward was, I think, the thing that catapulted Mickey Ward to getting those fights with Arturo Gatti. They had a hell of a fight on ESPN. So yeah, something tells me Kimbo is not necessarily going to have the same type of success there. The other person you just named, Gina Carano. I didn't really necessarily believe, I mean, the loss to Cyborg was bad, but I thought the performance was so valiant. They said, you know, a lot of people, they said, she's done, she's going to do movies now, she's not coming back, you know, she's going to come back. I mean, it was just, I thought it was too good. I mean, I guess I'm wrong. Is there any way that this woman comes back to MMA, or is she completely satisfied with what she accomplished and is doing other work?
Well, you know, I would have speculated, you know, just if we'd have done this last week, I would have speculated, well, maybe she's not coming back. Maybe she's going to make it in the movies. But Scott Coker did an interview this week, and he was confident that she was going to come back sometime this year. So, you know, assuming because he's the promoter, maybe he knows more than we do. So, you know, I'll take the gamble and say that maybe we do see her again, because I think that over time, her loss to Cyborg has become a little bit less jarring and maybe a little bit less embarrassing. At the time, it was just like, you know, wow, she got obliterated. But, you know, since then, we've seen everybody Cyborg's fought has been obliterated, you know, most of them worse than Gina Carano. So, I mean, if anything, Gina looks better now than she did at the time because, you know, at least she put up a good effort and some of the other girls haven't. So, you know, I hope that she's not done because, you know, for all the talk about, oh, she's just a pretty face, and, you know, she was a good fighter, and she was a tough fighter, and she really, you know, she was one of those girls that comes out to fight and really, you know, really wanted to throw down in there. So, I was always entertained by her, and when I interviewed her, she's real soft-spoken and real nice. So, you know, I'd like to see her back. I think she's good for especially for the females that want to make, you know, want to make women's MMA, you know, mainstream in any kind of significant way. They need someone like her, if not her. You know, they need a star in the worst way.
Is there, that wouldn't just be a promoter, though, being a promoter, would it? Would, you know, power of positive thought when it comes to Carano, or did he sound that kind of, or because I didn't see the interview, did he really come across as believing that she could come back? Because this is the one thing with the women's division is, unbelievable as it is to watch Cyborg, kind of in a position right now where it's like, she's got really no real opponents as far as what, you know, people who are perceived as threats to her. I mean, that's why I think Carano is more needed back than anything, too, because it brings back some cachet, I think, and some shine to that women's division, which is a great thing that they had that separated themselves from UFC. Do you think this could just be positive thought, or do you think he's that confident in her returning?
Maybe it is, you know, maybe he's trying to convince himself that it's true. But you're right that that's a division that needs something, you know. Like just this weekend there was a fighter on there, Amanda Nunez, I think is her name. She won by knockout at the last Strikeforce show Friday night. And, you know, I think she has maybe one or two fights in her career, and they're already talking about throwing her in there with Cyborg, you know, after one television appearance. So, you know they're desperate for somebody. So, you know, if Gina's smart, maybe she'll be able to kind of segue that need that they have to more money for her, which, of course, is the reason that everybody fights. So that would certainly increase the odds.
Herschel Walker, again, a lot of us being more Southern based, and a lot of people listening to this show, very familiar with Herschel Walker, obviously, with the name and everything he's accomplished athletically, in his life, the book, the football career, the in the Olympics, in the whole nine yards. He is an incredible freak of nature. If you're Strikeforce, is it enough? And obviously, Herschel Walker's going to do what he's going to do and what he feels comfortable with. But with that said, when it comes to his career, is it okay to have him fight every once in a while and to have it as just kind of like a showcase of, look what this amazing man at this age is able to accomplish? Or if he actually has somewhat of a curve, do you try to push him into, you know, bigger and bigger fights, or are you just happy to have Herschel Walker?
If if it's me, you don't. I don't want to see him in against like a legitimate contender or some young prospect they have or anything like that. I think that the reason they have Herschel Walker is so that they can put Herschel Walker on TV, and Herschel Walker can get them on ESPN, and he can get them on SportsCenter, he can get them on talk radio shows, he can get them in the newspaper, and you know, they use him for marketing. And I think that's really smart because, you know, he's a guy that brings credibility. You know, it comes with his name and all the things he's accomplished in football. So I think that's a tremendous benefit because that's hard for them because the UFC does have – it's the name that's associated with the sport. So it's hard for Strikeforce and other promotions to get anybody to pay attention. So anybody that can get them on television in a positive way, the way Herschel has, I think that's a good thing. The last thing they want is to put him in there, I think, with some good young fighter and have the story be, fledgling promoter gets Herschel Walker, you know, beaten half to death in the cage. You know, that's a bad story. Herschel Walker, you know, overcoming odds and being a 47-year-old athlete, you know, that's a good story. So, you know, let's keep those good stories. That would be my thought.
You know, if we were in Japan right now, we'd be talking about his fighting spirit as he fought Fedor.
You're right. Absolutely. You know, I'm sure there's probably some poor Japanese baseball player or television comedian that's going to get the crap kicked out of him sometime, you know, in this year. And it'll be all about Budo and his fighting spirit. But, you know, luckily, you know, we don't have that quite as much here, so.
Jacob Wolfman. Now, I'll be, I guess, you know, this is my terrible introductions, but in 2001, you joined the service due to 9/11, which I don't know if you want to talk about it or not. I know that that's been, you know, pretty much out there. People want to look at, you know, to look it up. But Jacob Wolfman makes what I, you know, did not think to be much of a comment about President Obama's policies. He gets a knock on the door from the Secret Service. Now, I know we live in amped up times, obviously what happened in Arizona over the weekend, but as a man who fought for our freedoms, what was your opinion on that? Because it didn't seem to be much of a comrade that the Secret Service, I mean, I think you could have, like, took the local sheriff out there with a bullet in his shirt pocket and said, you know, don't pull that out, but just ask a question.
I don't know. I mean, I don't think he was actually threatening the president or anything of that nature. I think, obviously, if you watched the interview that he did with Ariel Helwani, basically what happened is the reporter asked the fighter, hey, who do you want to fight next? And he said, maybe Obama. Somebody needs to knock some sense into him. That was the context of it. And that was the – I mean, that, I don't know. I don't think it was really that super threatening. But at the same time, I guess, you know, the Secret Service has a job to do, and – they went out and talked to him, and that was that. So, you know, and there's worse things, I guess, for fighters than, you know, it got him on the Tonight Show and, you know, a little bit of publicity so that, you know, maybe it worked out well for him.
Now, the website you work for, BloodyElbow.com, has been around for, it seems like it's been around forever, just because I remember hearing the name, I don't know how long it was ago, like, Bloody, what a weird name for a website, BloodyElbow.com. And then I ended up working for a website that's, you know, actually got a fuckthesnow.com lead into it that you can actually get to and on, so I guess I shouldn't judge anymore. But what is the website about for, I guess, those people out there, again, who just, you know, aren't big MMA fans and really all they know is wrestling? What takes place at BloodyElbow.com?
Well, at BloodyElbow.com, I mean, pretty much if it's happening in the world of mixed martial arts, we're talking about it. If it's happening in boxing or even professional wrestling a little bit, and if it relates to MMA, we're talking about it. So we do interviews with the fighters, but, you know, I think what we're probably most famous for are our opinion pieces, our editorials. So basically we take the topic of the day, whether it be like Brock Lesnar on The Ultimate Fighter or Jacob Wolfman, you know, being arrested by the Secret Service or whatever, you know, and we expound on it. We let people know what our views are. And then, of course, you know, there's a place for the fans to have their say at the bottom as well. So it's kind of a combination website slash message board. So, you know, it's a it's really grown a lot in the last year, especially. We've passed some of the big MMA sites that everyone's heard of, like MMA Weekly. You know, we get significantly more web traffic than they do now. So it's, you know, it's a site that's growing and growing. We're owned by SB Nation, which has fastly become one of the top 10 general sports websites, you know, just about sports on the entire internet. So, you know, within our network, we have a lot of options. If, you know, if you like MMA, we've got Bloody Elbow, and we've got MMA Mania. If you like professional wrestling, we have a Cage Site Seats, is our wrestling site. And and of course, we have sites on every sport and most of the major teams as well. So, I mean, if you're into it and it involves sports, we've got a blog for you almost certainly.
And you guys get to infect the airwaves the same way we do, too, with Luke Thomas, who's got the MMA Nation show, which emanates from WJFK in Washington, D.C. It's a fine station, too. Sports junkies in the morning love it. But 106.7 WJFK for that. And all the ranking system you have, which I think a lot of people have. USA Today, the show in Newark last year, the USA Today had a – I almost fell over when I opened up the paper and I saw the layout for it, that they were, you know, covering MMA. They took the rankings from your site, correct, to actually start when it comes to covering MMA, and they actually have ratings and they put them in the paper. That comes from your site, correct?
Yes, you're doing a much better job of promoting the site than I did. So I'm glad you're here. We're partnered with USA Today, which of course is a major thing. I mean, this is something that sports has been desperate for so long, to get coverage in places like the USA Today. And so we partner with them, SB Nation partners with the USA Today to put out our MMA rankings, which are famous for mostly for Dana White talking about how bad they are because they list fighters from other promotions. You know, the important thing to remember is that they're kind of like an accumulation or, you know, an averaging out of what's going on in rankings all over the internet. What we do is ask, you know, a variety of contributors, everyone from Jordan Breen from SureDog.com, which is one of the major MMA websites, to Kevin Ioli from Yahoo.com, who's kind of, you know, one of our mainstream contributors. All these rankings, you know, get mixed together and averaged out, and that's how we determine our own ranking. So it's, you know, it's not like the staff at Bloody Elbow is deciding who's the top fighter and who the 10th ranked fighter is. You know, that there's an internet-wide group that does that. So that's pretty cool. You know, there's a lot of input that goes into this.
See, I tell you that as we go out of this interview to plug Bloody Elbow and to plug Total MMA Inside Ultimate Fighting and to plug the MMA Encyclopedia, both books available everywhere, especially at ECW Press. But I guess I've already done that. I mean, is there anything else for you to plug?
At the moment, no. But I mean, there's so much going on. You know, I've you know, eventually we'll do this again in a year or so, or probably a year and a half, because I actually have two professional wrestling books that I've signed to write for ECW Press, and that's been a brand new eye-opening experience. The first one is about pro wrestling shooters, and it's you know, it'll be out in probably the beginning of 2012, and that's been really another one of these experiences where I thought I knew a lot, and I'm learning so much from people like Mark Hewitt and J.M. Kenyon and all these guys who have researched the history of professional wrestling so thoroughly. Working with these guys and newspaper archives and talking to fighters and promoters, we're going to kind of put together the story of professional wrestling back when the guys were legitimate tough guys, all the way up through the legitimate tough guys of today, like Brock Lesnar and Bobby Lashley and Kurt Angle and guys like that. So it's going to be the story of pro wrestling, and, you know, the sport that's always been, you know, laughed at a little bit. My premise is that, you know, from 1870 to the present, the toughest guy on the planet has probably been a professional wrestler. So go ahead and laugh at that. That's my book.
Duncan, it's a remarkable, I mean, that's a big undertaking, going to try to go back, to do anything with professional wrestling and getting straight stories from guys and trying to match them up. All of many of these years later, Dave Meltzer, still writing about the Billy Robinson Peter Maivia, you know, was an eye really bitten out and trying to shake out that story. When it came to thinking about this book, was this, what was the thought going into this, and did you step into it at first and go, oh, Jesus, what did I just walk, get myself into here with this?
Yeah, definitely. I definitely stepped in and said, wow, this is a lot more complicated than I thought. I'm kind of a cynic, maybe. So, I'm skeptical about every story that I hear. So, at the end of the day, it's professional wrestling, right? So it's going to be like every other project. There's probably going to be a lot of stuff in this book that's probably not right. Luckily, it'll be about people that are long dead and nobody will know. So that's a good thing.
Now, there should be a special chapter all their own for Mr. Thatcher, too, by the way.
Les, have you been involved in a lot of backroom shooting matches?
No, I have not. I was always smart enough to leave that to the guys who were really tough.
although we're still waiting for Les and Danny Hodge to get in the ring.
No, we're not either. No.
It's never too late.
Maybe when, I started to say maybe when Danny has to use a wheelchair, but hell, he still has his hands, so that would still put him at the advantage, for Christ's sake. No.
He's certainly going to be in the book. I mean, what a remarkable story, and to see him, like, even today, being able to grab an apple in one of his hands and just squeeze the life out of it. It's just, what an amazing individual, and, what a scary guy he must have been 20 or 30 years ago even,
I was going to say, you had to write nice things about him in the book because you can just rip it right in front of your face and drop it.
Well, we'll have to do that on YouTube or something. That would be a good promo.
Well, Jonathan, and really, totally on the inside, Ultimate Fighting, and it's not just saying it because you're on. I mean, it really is. If there's anyone who actually wanted to go back and get a coherent look at the history of MMA and follow it along and get some really eye-opening and surprising things for somebody who's just come around to MMA, I mean, it really is a fantastic book. And the MMA Encyclopedia, too, was being a reference geek was just a undertaking that I'm glad you took. And both of those books, again, available from ECW Press. And I just want to thank you very much for being on the show tonight.
Hey, listen, I really appreciate you guys having me on. It's been my pleasure.
All right, man, and I think we're going to go to a little 60-second break, and we'll be back right after this.
Hi, I'm Drew Brees, NFL quarterback for the New Orleans Saints, here with Bugs Bunny to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you fuel your body and your mind.
So what do you like to throw around the football like Drew?
Skateboard.
Play 50 in the park.
Ride a bike.
Kick the soccer ball around.
Or dance in your room.
Just move it your way.
Because nothing makes you feel better than moving every day.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
So be a player.
You'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
Move it your way and be a player.
Get up and play an hour a day, Doc. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
That's right, at letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
Okay, so recent WWE Hall of Fame classes following the, or I guess preceding WrestleMania pay-per-views in the cities where they're at seem to have been following a theme, digging back to the legends that may be from that area. Florida rings a bell, Texas rings a bell, the Minnesota guys ring a bell. They come to Atlanta. Shawn Michaels, obviously, you know he's going in. Not a big deal about him being going in out of Atlanta. It makes perfect sense. Maybe the time's right for that. Congratulations to Shawn. But, guys, have you seen the rest of the list of the people that they're talking about going in?
No.
I'm not sure I want to. Because I'm going to tell you right now, the names that have been rumored that said they were going to show up, it would make sense if they did this in their world, but I would be stunned if it had, you know, just, you know, I'll just have to shake my head. Are
well,
you talking
you know,
about the NWO?
You know, when you think back and you look at what they did with Florida, a lot of good there. What they did with Texas, a lot of good there. You know, it fit. It wasn't just, there's always some agenda pushing. You know that. There's always stuff about marketing. You know that. When it comes to Georgia, there's no Ray Gunkel or Tommy Rich or Mr. Wrestling 2 or an Ole Anderson. No, we got Dean Malenko, Lex Luger, the Honky Tonk Man, Medusa. These are names on the table. Medusa? Really?
Well, you know,
why?
In any city, why Medusa? But Arn Anderson, okay, I'll give you that one. All right, I'll give you that one. Ron Simmons, yeah, I'll give you that one. Local guy, but my God, you know, they're talking about Sting. I guess to some degree, maybe that makes sense if they work that out down the road. But you know, Bill Goldberg. Come on. I don't know. There's so many other names that I think should be going in on this list, and to me it's just pathetic.
You know, the sad thing, though, Rich, is that they like to give the image that they invented professional wrestling or sports.
Exactly. And that's just it. I mean, we're only going to go back as far as, you know, Jim Crockett Promotions after Black Saturday. I mean, you know, come on. There was a lot of great wrestling going on in this territory down here well before 1984.
Well, even
you know,
if you went back to just 1984, there's a lot better people than, you know, are on that list that they're talking about.
Well, you know, but some of those guys, well, like Ole. First of all, you'd have to drop a bomb in his house to get him out to accept something, but then you'd have to hit the censor button every 15 seconds when he was making his accepted speech. But it would be entertaining. There's no two ways about it. And when I say that, I don't mean that he shouldn't, you know, that, yeah, I mean, there's so many guys that are worthwhile. You know, something that somebody mentioned to me a while back, and I thought, yeah. But some of the bookers from the, you know, the 60s and the 70s warrant recognition. You know, announcers get it, wrestlers get it, you know, so forth, so on. But these are the guys that were the puppet masters, right? I mean, these are the guys
Absolutely.
Who pulled the strings and made it work.
Sure.
And Leo Garibaldi comes to mind immediately.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I've told kids, I said, you know, here's a guy, you want to talk about a man with a tremendous mind. I said, you got to realize he was in one state, and how long did the Andersons feud with the Torreses? You know, as one example, that he was sharp enough mentally and manipulated it so beautifully that it was, you know, they kept it fresh all the time. I mean, obviously the guys in the ring had to be sharp too, but I mean, you know, the guy pulling the strings is so damn important.
I'm with you on that. Another thing I wanted to bring up, obviously, I found this interesting. I know, you know, ESPN doing their big 30 for 30 thing. Did you guys happen to catch the one on Marcus Dupree?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That was great, great television. Obviously, Wrestling Observer reporting this week that he is, let's see, he's 46, and he is not only going to be wrestling on a show in Philadelphia, Mississippi on February 19th, but he's promoting the show. Apparently, he's going to be teaming up with Tommy Rich against Doug Gilbert and Davey Rich, and also on the card, Kamala, Road Dogg, and Coco Beware. I don't remember. It says here that he became a pro wrestler working with Jerry Jarrett. I don't remember that.
Yeah,
I don't
it
either.
Was quick because I think they had him teaming up with Jeff Gaylord, or they had Gaylord was there at the time that had happened. But I mean, it was quick in and quick out.
Yeah, I don't remember any of that either.
Yeah, it was real quick.
And also, I guess while we're talking about Memphis, Guy Coffey, Les, were you familiar with him?
Oh, sure. Yeah, Mr. Coffey was a nice guy. He was, when I first met him in 68, when I first went into the territory, he managed the old Memphis Auditorium. And he was a guy who Lawler drew the pictures of the wrestlers for to put in his office so he could get into the matches for free when he was a kid. And then he became buddy. Well, he was Mr. Coffey was friends with everybody, but he got pretty close with Jerry. But even before that, he was close with Jackie Fargo. A really, really nice guy. They're saying it was suicide, right? That he committed suicide.
Yeah, apparently so. I don't know if that's the official report yet, but from what I'm hearing, yeah. And obviously, I guess that happened over the weekend. How old was he?
Late 80s, as far as I could tell you. I don't know for sure. But, yeah, I'm assuming that it was maybe, you know, due to health-related things. I don't know either. You know, I'm just taking a guess. But, yeah,
it says here that he had been, I guess, a part of the scene back to the 1950s, so... So that, you know, that age-wise, I guess that maybe puts it upright. But you hate to hear that, somebody that age, you know.
Yeah, and you know, normally too, it would stand out back then because usually, you know, somebody outside of the business, especially like a building manager, wouldn't have been in tight with the boys, you know.
Right.
But which was an unusual thing. He was. And yeah, it's my experience with him was he was a real gentleman, real nice guy.
Did y'all hear about the promoter that was arrested for not paying his talent?
Yeah,
the guy.
Yeah,
in,
I
West
read that.
Isn't that priceless?
Well, he didn't pay the cops he brought in for security, so that's why they arrested him.
Yeah. But you know, all the workers of America are sitting here thinking right now, man, that should be going on a lot more frequently.
Oh, yeah. Well, listen, you know, I'm going to tell you, I was talking to somebody about this the other day. Some of the younger guys, when I say younger, a lot younger than me, have posted some things on Facebook in the last few weeks about Austin Aries was one about the promoters and the indie promoters and wrestlers who say we just want to have fun. He said, why? You know, how about this is a business? How about getting serious about it and let's all make some money? And this is not and realize Austin Aries is not an old guy that's bitter. He's not, you know, but he's making ways for. I mean, it's true. You know, it's really true. Bo James, who has honestly, not a veteran as such, but he's been around the business, I guess, almost 20 years. I didn't realize he'd been around that long, but he's up in the Tri-City, you know, Johnson City, Kingsport, Bristol area. I had listed a bunch of things I miss in professional wrestling, and, a long list, which so many of us chimed in, amen, you know, to that. Some of the young promoters, wrestlers, bookers, whatever, should take heed to some of this stuff. Because it's not 70-year-old guys or 60-year-old guys, you know, saying something because they're bitter, because they're mad, because they can't do a somersault or some goofy excuse for a guy telling the truth. I think there's a lot of credence to that, and it should be taken note of. I don't know if I'd mention this to you guys or not. Do you realize in the state of Kentucky now, if you want to train to be, if I wanted to go down to Louisville and sign up and pay my money to be trained at OVW, I have to have a boxing and wrestling commission license in the state of Kentucky.
I think I remember hearing that, but even just to train?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, absolutely. And if I went from that school to, I don't even know where the hell there's another school in the state of Kentucky, but if I went from that school to another one, I have to get another license.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah,
I
wouldn't say there's
any
bureaucracy to this. I wouldn't say it's the state trying to bleed anybody for money. Don't get me wrong here.
No, no.
You know, when I heard this, I said, you know, they ought to, if they want to license somebody, they ought to take Danny Davis and Jimmy Cornette and have them, if you want to train wrestlers, if you want to be a trainer, if you want to open a school. Now, you get in front of these guys and pass a written exam or let them see what you actually know, and then they'll decide whether you're qualified to even run a damn school. But that's the thing. Your next-door neighbor, Rich, could move to Kentucky. He could be an insurance salesman and open a wrestling school, and he don't need a license for that. But if you're going to train there, you have to spend $20 a year to get a license. And you're not even a wrestler considered. You're just learning. So, that's kind of bogus, I think.
Yeah, politics gone awry. I wanted to ask you about this guy. Obviously, from your neck of the woods, you may have frequented this place. Naughty Body, Sean Casey, being investigated by the IRS.
Yes.
I'm sure you're hearing about that.
I have known Sean since he was 15 years old.
Has he been like this since he was 15?
No. But you know what? First of all, he wasn't a WWE superstar. He never had a contract. I don't know where that he probably started misconception. There's nobody a bigger fan of Sean's than Sean. Take my word for it.
Well, that's common in the business.
He met Jimmy Cornette through me. I took him down to Smokey one time as enhancement talent years ago. He did work on the OVW shows, but he never was under contract. And he did some enhancement work for WWE as well. He has run this, rent a dancer thing, male and female, for years. And he himself, you know, was a male dancer. And he's lived a lifestyle. I mean, you know, him and a couple of ladies on his arm downtown in the clubs or across the river in northern Kentucky in the clubs. But what happened was, there's been some trouble over the last couple of years, different things popped up. One of the dancers was in his at his home with his at that point live-in girlfriend, who someone told me that they had since parted company. But anyway, this girl filed a complaint that Sean and his girlfriend had gotten her high and tried, you know, to rape her or something like that. And she didn't win the case, although I wouldn't doubt that she's right about that. But, you know, the whole thing, what happened last is that there's been some zoning things. And I guess, I don't know, some of the dancers, the reporter on Channel 12 here said that some of the dancers had actually said to some, I guess to the wrong people, that we do more than just dance. And so anyway, they raided his home. They had a search warrant and raided his home. He doesn't live, I guess, 20 minutes from me, took a lot of records and papers and stuff. And then, which I didn't know, he had rented a house in a residential section over in northern Kentucky, just across the river, as another office. And they actually broke the door down there to get in. But it was the IRS and the Vice Squad. And they interviewed a neighbor over in northern Kentucky, and this guy said, well, we thought maybe it was prostitution, you know, because we saw these girls going in and out and so forth and so on. But the government, the IRS and the Vice Squad are kind of, keep playing it close to the vest with this reporter. But the speculation is it's about tax evasion and prostitution, and when I say I can't stand here and say it's true or it's false, but, you know, Sean was a clubber, man. He lived the lifestyle. When I first met him, was training at a gym close to the house here, Royal Fitness, and he came up to me and he said, somebody said you used to be a wrestler. And I said, yeah, I did. And he said, well, I'm going to be a wrestler someday, and I'm going to do my hair this way and paint my faces, get this, you know, music and this costume. He said, what do you think? I said, I think maybe you should learn to wrestle first. There'd be a club right there. He worked for me a little bit, but, you know, I told Sean a long time ago, I said, you know, here's the thing. You're either going to be a male dancer who has wrestling as a hobby, or you're going to be a wrestler and have dancing a hobby. You can't, you know, push yourself at both. And, of course, with wrestling, Sean's only about 5'6", but he was in good shape. He got a picture in Playgirl magazine a number of years ago and that sort of thing. But, I haven't heard any more about it since the news item last week. So
I think Mike has that issue of Playgirl. Hey, just one question about the IRS.
I'm thinking right now. The only thing I'm thinking about is what exactly do adult entertainers put on their W-4s? I mean, what do you claim there?
I don't have a clue. I've never been an adult entertainer, Mike, so I couldn't tell you. The thing that was never mentioned on that news item, but came to my mind, is there's an office in Ohio and there's an office in Kentucky. And if indeed prostitution comes into this, there's that thing about transporting across the state line,
interstate
which
commerce.
Becomes then a federal offense. It's not the local vice squad any longer.
Oh, Sean.
Well, I don't know. So I don't know, you know, but that's I know Sean, absolutely. So that's the deal.
Well, the only other question I got here about this then is when the IRS went in, was Mike Rotundo one of the agents?
He probably was.
Just had to get it out there. Les, we got a question for you from the chat room. Larry from the chat room wants to know if there was ever a particular wrestler that you never got a chance to work with, but always wanted to.
Absolutely. My childhood idol, Buddy Rogers.
All right.
That's the one thing that I feel I never was able, you know, I mean, if I could back up, I mean, there's probably a lot of things I'd do if I could back up and be young again and go through the business. But that would be the one thing that I would love to have done, yeah, because Buddy Rogers is, you know, the picture's been out there on the Internet somewhere of me when I was 12 years old with a picture taken with him at the old Music Hall down here in Cincinnati at the matches. But, Rogers was the guy that fascinated me to no end, and Lord knows that once I got smart to the business, I realized I couldn't have picked a better role model in terms of in-ring performance, you know, in my life. But I never actually worked a territory with this guy. I never even actually met him. Ernie Roth. Ernie and I were buddies, and Ernie had lived. This is a Grand Wizard I'm talking about. For those who don't know who Ernie Roth is, okay. Ernie lived with Buddy and Buddy's wife in Columbus for a year when he was early in the business, and Ernie had a tremendously fertile mind for the business in terms of finishes and angles, and so he and Buddy were close. And Ernie told me one time he knew, you know, that I was a big BR fan, and he called me one day. He said, you know, if you'd like to go to New York, Buddy's working the territory now. He said, I hesitated because I realized at the time, you know, it was all the big guys, you know, were the thing in New York, and I realized it probably would, you know, be short run and everything, and there was no guarantee that I was going to get to work with Buddy anyway, so I passed on it. But I never even had the chance to sit down and talk to the guy, you know, and say, hey, man, you know, you're one of the reasons I'm here. But that, yes, if there's anything I'd like to go back and do, it'd be to work a match with Buddy Rogers.
Go ahead.
Well, I'd say, actually, you know, we always ask you, who was somebody you would like to wrestle with? Was there ever a move to a territory or just a move in general that you maybe now you look back and go, maybe I should have jumped at that one or something along those lines?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I probably should have gone to Australia when I had the chance. and Japan, you know. We were supposed to go to Japan when Matsuda and Duke Kiyomuka, when they were getting ready to start, involved in that startup promotion over there. That was sort of an opposition. Kirby and Hall and I were supposed to go on a tour, and for some reason the tour itself got canceled or postponed. And so it just never happened. And a couple other times there was an opportunity for me to go, but I was doing well in whatever territory I was in at the time, and I just didn't want to break the flow. So I said, well, I'll put it off. And, of course, then it just never happened, you know. So, I would have liked to make, you know, probably would have made liked to made both of those trips. But, as far as I never worked Portland. A lot of people wanted me to go to Portland, and I never did. And I passed on Oklahoma a couple times simply because I just didn't want to make the trips. I didn't burn the bridge, but, there's a couple times that they were said, well, you know, the door's open here if you'd like to come in.
Maybe you could have had that elusive match with Danny Hodge out there.
Well, I was able to work with Danny in Knoxville territory. Thank you very much. And got it done. Listen, I don't have any problem putting Danny Hodge over.
I'm sorry, Les. What was the reputation of Portland at the time? Because going back to watch, old tapes, I had access to a lot of stuff, but I never really got to see Portland. So going back to watch the tapes, it just didn't seem that great for me. But I always remember reading the magazines and just how, spectacular it was. And Don Owen, who was supposed to be, I know people look at him as a Hall of Fame promoter and a all-around great guy, and a lot of names, came out of there and developed there. What was the reputation of Portland in the wrestling business? Is there anything that talks a lot now?
One of the things that a lot of people, said, hey, why don't you go to Portland, was because there was a lot of junior heavyweights there. But and it wasn't, the trips weren't god-awful. And it was just, I guess the weather was pretty much was, pretty much the reason I stayed in the Southeast once I made the move down there in 66 was because, you weren't going to get, unless it's this week, you weren't going to get snowed out, of shots. And, so you weren't going to miss as many shots as you might miss if you worked Minneapolis or Boston or someplace like that. So, I know a lot of guys that went there and did really well, and there was a lot of good workers came out of there too. So Matt Bourne and his dad, Tony, Piper, cut his teeth up there. So it was a good territory. I shouldn't say I never met Don Owen. I met him at NWA at Alliance meeting in Vegas, just hello and was introduced in a brief conversation. But, everybody loved the territory that worked at it. I know Roger Kirby worked the territory. He liked it. There was a lot of good guys came out of there. But the main reason, because I was a junior heavyweight, a lot of people said, you should try Portland. But I truthfully, back then realized the trip, and then to find out that it's not going to work out or that business is down, and then, looking to get out of the northwestern part of the United States and move back, to the Midwest or the South. It was just, I always tried to keep the, traveling was not my favorite part of being a professional wrestler. I might have wrestled a few more years if I could have wrestled in the same town three or four times a week.
I would have wrestled in Hawaii full time.
Oh, I would have liked that too. Well, that was a lot back then, back in the, especially in the 60s and 70s, a lot of the guys on their way to Japan or back, coming back, would stop off and work. You could work two shots and make a good payday in Hawaii and spend the rest of the time on the beach. So a lot of the guys did that. Yeah, that would have been a great territory. I didn't think to mention that, but yeah, it wouldn't have made me mad to spend a few months in that territory because they only worked once or twice a week anyway.
So. You just gave me an idea for something we need to tackle next week because I don't think we got enough time to fit it into the rest of this show. But I'd love to know from you being there firsthand exactly what the hell went on at these NWA meetings.
I can't tell you. I had somebody ask me that too, Rich. But when I say that, if you weren't an official member, I mean, I went with Ron Fuller, you know, as part of the Knoxville office. But when it came down to the super secretive things, it was only the actual promoters, owners of the territory that stayed in those meetings. In other words, we could come in, you know, for the introduction, you know, in a general conversation. But once it got down to, you know, selecting the next champion or determining whatever else, I'm not sure because I wasn't, you know, we were asked to leave the room.
So what, you're hanging out at the pool or the hotel bar?
Absolutely.
Nothing wrong with that.
Nothing. I wasn't mad about that either. But I know one year, Buddy, Ron's dad, you know, Buddy Fuller went, was out there with us, and Buddy didn't own any piece of anything at that particular point in time. And when it came down to the super secret stuff, he walked out with me.
Fuller didn't own anything?
Apparently,
wow.
Because he didn't stay in, or at least he was not a dues-paying member of the NWA at that time.
Uh-huh.
Because I remember that, you know, that particular meeting that, you know, when I got up to leave, I was surprised that he did too, but he and I went and had lunch, as I recall. But, So what went on inside? Now, you know, there was a lot of networking and, you know, you meet a lot of people. And even in the social atmosphere, in the lounges and stuff, you know, a lot of business was transacted there, too.
Let's go in for Goulas, do you know? Or did he go himself? Who represented Nick Goulas, or did he go himself, to your knowledge?
Oh, yeah, he would go, sure.
Okay.
Yeah, Goulas went. A lot of the even back then, that's where I first met Vincent Kay. I first met Vince there. He was there with his dad. They were members of the Alliance back then. That would have been
right.
The late 70s, mid late 70s. They were still members of the Alliance at that time. Even though they had their own champion and everything, they still were members of the Alliance.
Sure. Hey, We're getting ready to wrap it up here, but I do want to try to just ask you one more question before we fit in our plugs. You talk about wanting to work with Buddy Rogers, never having the opportunity, but did you ever get to work with Bruno, who so many people, you know, liken those two together? You can't have one without the other.
No, never worked with Bruno either. I met Bruno briefly during my career, but actually spent more time talking to him at that big fan fest thing down in Tampa a few years ago.
Cool.
Yeah, but no, I worked in Pittsburgh a couple times out of here doing just when I was young and went up there to do a couple jobs, but that's as far, and of course broke in Boston, but I never worked the New York territory at all.
All right. Guys, you want to go ahead and get some plugs in real quick? Less.
I got nothing to plug. Well, I can tell you that I'll be with Mike Johnson on PW Insider on Thursdays and Saturdays on Wrestling Weekly with Doc Young and Will Strauss on Figure Four and Observer site, along with the great world-renowned Mike Sempervisi. And when I know there's a show on Wednesday nights, I actually show up here once in a while.
Yeah. Go ahead, Mike. What you got?
If you like hearing me hear myself talk, Adam and Mike, Big Audio Nightmare, should be recording one tomorrow night for the previously mentioned Figure Four Weekly, WrestlingObserver.com Empire, and also be doing a show with Brian Alvarez on Sports Byline on Sunday from 6 to 8, Wrestling Observer Live. So, more of me.
And may I say if you love hearing profanity laced rants, then you'll want to listen to Brian Alvarez
because his
rants are far more entertaining than mine. Believe me.
We need a drop board with him screaming "Why?"
All right. Let's see. Tomorrow night here on the GWH Radio Network, Peach State Pandemonium with Mike Norris, Jerry Oates, and Bobby Simmons. And, of course, let's see, here next week we're going to have Johnny Mantel. That ought to be some fun. And, apparently, let's see, that's going to do it for us this week. As always, check GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. And don't forget, we're now on Twitter. So all you Twitter freaks, go find us. All right.
So if you want to know if Rich Tate has gas or is sick or his car is not in the garage, just check him on Twitter. He'll tell you.
Sure, absolutely. All right, we'll see you back here next week.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, the latest news on pro wrestling and MMA, and more. GWH thanks you for your support.